Hello!
Hello!
And welcome to the ADHD Science Podcast.
Welcome.
I'm Max Davey.
I'm Tess Davey, as always.
As always. And we are slick as anything today on our second attempt at recording this intro.
Yes, I got something in my eye.
And now you do not. Or do you? Who knows?
No. So,
we may have some new listeners today because I did a talk, which was essentially a kind of hour-long plug for the podcast.
You
welcome.
A talk, I stood there with a microphone and I agreed with you.
That is not how it worked. You weren't even there. You were working.
Oh, I thought you meant the one in Norwich.
No, the one in Bristol that I did this week.
Oh, that's
But you're right, the one in Norwich was also a bit of a plug for the...
Yes.
For the
If you're coming from that, you're
podcast.
A little late, but
little late.
Also welcome.
Welcome. Everybody... Yeah, so what's happening today? So unfortunately, it's one that you were not able to attend
Mm-mm.
the recording of because you were busy working.
I was, as always.
Let me tell you about this episode, Tess. It was with Isabella Barclay. Isabella Barclay is a final year PhD student at the University of Cardiff.
Wonderful.
So she's done a paper, and basically what she's looking at is a very large cohort. There's this thing called the Millennium Cohort, which is everyone who's born at around the millennium
right.
in a particular area.
Mm-hmm.
Has some area of England, I can't remember exactly.
Gotcha.
And it's a cohort of people, and they follow them throughout the time, over time. So they're now about 25, well... When they were being researched, they were less. So what they've been able to do is basically get a huge amount of data about a huge number of people who are not, like, selected.
Yeah.
It's just the whole population, a sample of the whole population. So what they... it's a really rich data set. And what she was looking at, what are the factors, first of all, which decide how late within childhood you get a diagnosis? So it's not about late diagnosis like
so
my diagnosis.
The Millennium Cohort, do they all have ADHD?
No. So it's
Do some
it's,
of them have ADHD?
Yes.
How many people, roughly?
I don't know exactly what proportion.
I'm talking like 20.
You're talking about very large numbers of people in the cohort, like
right.
thousands of people in the
thousands
cohort
of people,
and hundreds
yes.
of people with ADHD.
Amazing.
I guess.
That makes
Do you see
sense.
What I mean?
Yeah.
Tens of thousands of people in the cohort. A very,
okay,
very
so
large data set.
So how early on in life do they get a diagnosis?
So what they did is they looked at 7 and 10, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it's essentially kind of within primary school age groups. And it looked at which ones got early diagnosis and which ones got late diagnosis. So it's sort of who got picked up first.
Classifying as early and late, are we classifying 7 as early and 10
yeah,
as late?
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
So more or less, I mean, obviously there's a very, very large
yeah.
spectrum of late after, you know, towards the end of primary school.
Mm.
But I think it's at least an indication of...
It's definitely still worth looking at.
And it's an indication of trends that then will continue later on in life
mm-hmm.
as to who is getting picked up and who isn't.
Gotcha.
Because it's not only... She looked not only at when people got a diagnosis, but actually whether people had symptoms and whether those symptoms were... recognize. So when they had the symptoms of ADHD but not a diagnosis, then that
mm-hmm.
was also an interesting
gotcha.
Pattern of data. So basically what she found was the sort of least surprising thing is that
Well, okay, fine.
But there are lots of different factors behind it.
Gotcha.
I think it's worth spoiling it in inverted commas a little bit because actually what there's an awful lot to process
Go
in
ahead.
The episode.
You were saying females?
So females tend to be diagnosed later.
Gotcha.
People who are less disruptive and whose emotions are better controlled
Very
tend to be
yes.
tend to be diagnosed later. And in terms of the recognition, the thing that's most interesting and the most important is whether you also have an autism diagnosis. If you have an autism diagnosis, you're more likely to be diagnosed with ADHD.
Really? I would have thought that it might be different to that in that people who have autism, their ADHD symptoms might just be put down as autism.
Exactly.
Symptoms.
But it looks like at a population level...
But I suppose once you're in the clinician's office...
Once you're in the system, you're
yeah.
more likely to be picked up. That's the And that's actually quite good for me because I worry about that as well.
Mm.
So yeah, I mean, that's sort of a very brief summary, and
well,
obviously
I can't
dive
wait
in
to find out more.
Dive into it,
but I
think it's a useful summary because there is a lot to process in this episode. So shall we go straight in?
Yes, let's go. I'll see you on the outro.
Oh, one thing quickly: there is a moment quite soon after the beginning of the episode where Isabella's audio quality, I've managed to salvage the volume, but the audio quality isn't great. I've done what I can with my limited skills to fix that. But yeah, don't switch it off, because for 20 seconds, she sounds all kind of crunchy. 20 seconds, that well-known number, 20. yeah, so don't switch it off.
Yes, it does come back.
Yeah, it does come back. Exactly right.
Let's jump in.
Hi, Future Max here. I got it slightly wrong. Isabella looked at data points at 7, 11 and 14. So I was slightly wrong on my summary because I wasn't expecting Tess to have asked actual questions. But I suppose that's more fool me. So anyway, that's the correct answer to her question about Isabella's study. Just so that's because Isabella runs through it quite quickly. So just to say, it's 7, 11 and 14. Okay, bye. Okay, so welcome, Isabella, to the ADHD Science podcast. If you could introduce yourself to the listeners and we'll crack on with our interview.
Yeah, fantastic. So my name is Isabella Barclay. I am a third and hopefully final year PhD student at Cardiff University. I research ADHD. I also have ADHD diagnosed a few years ago.
Great. I picked up really a paper that you had put out as one of the authors about late diagnosis in ADHD and sort of, you know, some of the reasons why that happens. So I that's obviously something that's very, very pertinent, I think, particularly to the audience that ADHD UK connects with, a lot of adults diagnosed late in adulthood. So that's really what we're going to talk about today. So if we can start in the absence of Tess, unfortunately, once again, is not here for the recording. But we'll start with the first question. It's always this weird bit because she usually reads the question out. So I'm like, where's Tess? What's going on? So what was the question you were answering in your paper?
So the question I was answering, so it was kind of a subsection of my overarching PhD question, which is, why are some people diagnosed with ADHD later than others? Why are some people not diagnosed at all? And is there a difference between sexes? Before I go into this, I would like to note that I use the term male and female as I discuss the paper. That's just because the data that I've got goes on assigned sex at birth, doesn't really have any information on gender and things. So, yeah. I would like to make a note of that I acknowledge that, sex isn't necessarily binary, but I will be using male and female as I discuss it.
The big study on gender diversity and ADHD is still needs to happen and will be fascinating when it comes.
Yeah, no, I fully, but there is such a, just amongst the people that I know who are neurodiverse, there is such a huge percentage of gender diversity that I wouldn't want to, erase anyone from this group. Going on the nature of longitudinal data.
Yeah, use the data you've got, yeah.
Exactly, it tends to be assigned, whatever sex they were assigned at birth is what I have to go off. That was same when I've been using the really fantastic study, the Millennium Cohort Study, and the question that I was looking to answer was, why are some people diagnosed slightly earlier and why are some people diagnosed slightly later, and why do some people have ADHD symptoms but don't receive a diagnosis at all within the scope of my study, which was looking at people between the ages of 5 and 14. And trying to see if there were any sex differences there to try and explain kind of the well-known gap that is quite evident in kind of male and females receiving their diagnosis of ADHD in a timely manner.
Yeah. Just to track back a little bit, I mean, I am aware of the Millennium Cohort Study, but it might be worth just
I don't think you know the first Millennium Cohort Study person, unless Abby Russell's also, no, she's Alice Back. So yes, I think you're the first person for, who's using that cohort, that data set. So it'll be really helpful to explain what that is.
Absolutely. So the Millennium Cohort Study, it's a longitudinal study that was done or is being done in the UK. And there's like, you know, tens of thousands of people that included all who were born around the year 2000. The data was collected periodically. So I am interested in the ages, which were 5, 7, 11 and 14. There were some time points collected before this and some time points that have been collected afterwards. And yeah, basically just collects data about the people, kind of what they get up to in their daily lives. You know, they ask them questions about their health. Early on, they ask them questions about their parents and stuff like that. It's just a really rich data set of people in the UK, essentially, that's been following them over the years.
And the key is, as a cohort, it gets rid of some of the bias of, oh, I'm just picking up people from a particular clinic or who answered a particular survey. It's everybody. It's just a chunk of the population that you're just lifting out and going, this is what the population looks like.
Yeah, and they were really good. They oversampled in like particular groups who are more likely to like drop out and things like that. So it's quite representative.
So oversampled is that they had more people who were likely to drop out, so they ended up with a more representative sample over time.
I believe so. That's kind of what they were going for with that.
But it's very well. The point is, it's a very well established, very respected data set that you're working from. That's the key.
Yeah, fantastic.
And so obviously you would look at who's been diagnosed and you'd find that out from GP records or?
So unfortunately this one wasn't linked to health records, but they had a question at ages 5, 7, 11 and 14 where they asked specifically, has your child been diagnosed with ADHD? To which I could answer yes or no.
Or
just didn't answer. So that's how I determined whether they'd received a diagnosis.
So that's less perfect, but also health records have got their own problems as well. And how did you find, I know we're sort of diving a little bit into your findings, but I'm just sort of interested, how did you find the people who had the symptoms but hadn't been diagnosed?
So that was using something called the Strengths and Difficulties Questionnaire, which is a parent-reported questionnaire of ADHD symptoms, which is like clinically kind of like, tested cutoff point for like high symptoms. So there are like approved high cutoff, medium and low and stuff like that. So I took people who'd kind of scored above the high threshold on the SDQ for ADHD related symptoms.
Yeah, and that's mainly focusing on hyperactivity, isn't it, really? But that's probably a reasonable marker.
Yeah, more hyperactive questions than inattentive questions.
And the SDQ is absolutely a standard instrument. It's used absolutely all the time.
Yes.
It's amazingly well used. Okay, so again, you've got lots of robust stuff going on there. So time to ask you, what did you find with your data set?
Well, yes, no, that was exciting. So just to backtrack a little bit, there was a wealth of data in the MCS, so I had to choose what I wanted to look at based on past literature, what was going to be viable sample sizes, especially because I wanted to potentially look at sex differences, things like that. And the factors that I ended up looking at were cognitive ability, parental depression or anxiety, maternal higher education, hobby frequency, autism diagnosis, physical activity, emotional dysregulation, and then I used the other SDQ things, which were pro-social, peer problems, conduct problems, and emotional problems. So that is what I looked at So
I think I probably missed a few of those. Yeah. But it's basically, I mean, I think it's probably, it sounds like it's chosen on the basis of things that we know have been shown previously to affect the severity of ADHD symptoms and also people's chances of getting a diagnosis. So you're drawing on an existing literature.
What's known, what's been proven, what's just kind of, you know, been assumed, because it's always be like one of those things where I'd speak to people like, oh yeah, well, you all know if you're smart in school, you don't get diagnosed. I'm like, I feel like, you know, we think we know a lot of these things, but getting kind of the evidence to support that is really, yeah, important.
Still important.
And,
yeah.
Yeah. And also the sex differences, a lot of things, it kind of, and like the importance of sex differences is something that's really kind of coming up recently and kind of,
yeah,
is having a rise in its, in people realizing it's important. So being able to look at the sex differences was kind of like a key aspect of that, and just to see if anything here could explain why there is just this difference in, you know, females tending to receive their diagnosis a bit later than males and being missed and that sort of thing.
So you had this really complex matrix in a way of different factors in for different people. And how did you untangle that and work out what the factors were that were important and which were just...
So, I mean, I had a very long list before I started. Some of it was the questions weren't, like, they didn't quite ask the question in a way that would give me, like, specific enough data. So something I was interested in was, I couldn't look at things past age 14, for example, because they started asking the questions in a different way. They asking about, has your child had a diagnosis of ADHD? They started asking, has your child had an ADHD or autism diagnosis? So some of the factors, I can't remember any off the top of my head, but yeah, sometimes they changed the wording. Sometimes they it just wasn't quite what I would have wanted to look at / would have been useful. Other things where I was like, oh, that's a fantastic question. I then looked at my data and then there was like one person. That helped cut down a few. But then at the end of the day, it was kind of just looking at them and being like, what is going to be the most like interesting and useful to know? What's going to, what's going to answer these questions in potentially the most useful way? And from then I kind of, as I was building my analysis plan, just like knocking off things that, you know, might not have been that helpful, might not have been that relevant to young people. Obviously, my sample is only up to age 14. So there were some things I was like, oh, actually, I don't think, you know, stuff like alcohol use might not have been as...
No, relevant. They're just like, getting started on that by 14, aren't they?
So. Yeah, exactly. So it was kind of a lot of working out what was going to be the most useful. And then what's going to be, from then it was seeing what of those were going to be viable with the specific kind of samples that I'd created based on my definitions.
Okay, so you've got this population, and I can just see the audience going, okay, this is a lot. You've got these populations with different things that are true about them, and you can split them up in lots of millions of different ways to find out who is more or less likely to have got a diagnosis of ADHD. And also you can probably, it's to some degree connect how many of them get a diagnosis and look at that against how many of each group have the symptoms.
Yeah. So I did two different comparisons. My first comparison, I split up. So I had data from 5, 7, 11, and 14. I split it into 5 and 7, and then 11 and 14. So kind of class one is slightly earlier, one is slightly later. And I basically just looked to see if these factors were associated with either one of the earlier or the later groups. And then I did a similar comparison where I had all those who'd been diagnosed, and compared them to those who had the high symptoms but no diagnosis, kind of investigating, do these factors impact timing? Do these factors impact whether they're diagnosed at all?
Diagnosability or not, yeah. I don't know what that word would be. I know what you mean.
Yeah.
We should come up with one. So I think that's now the time to ask, what did you find? What were the factors that were really important?
So... I've got my notes on the screen. I am not relying on my memory for anything. So I'll work section by section. In the first aim, where I compared the earlier versus slightly later recognized ADHD, I found that those with later ADHD were more likely to have higher cognitive ability and better pro-social skills, which are, you know, essentially when someone behaves in a way that benefits other people, society, etc. suggesting that these could be linked to like potential protective mechanisms for individuals. And then they also make sense. We figured because lower school achievement may lead to a teacher or like another member of staff to consider ADHD referral, kind of the way that schools operate, you know, if there's a problem with learning, grades, meeting achievements, that's when things kind of get escalated.
May also be that the child who's not engaged that well in school in lessons is not achieving and is also behaviorally very challenging.
Exactly. There's all sorts of things like that that all kind of may make someone more likely to be picked up and have someone notice, whether it's noticing their ADHD symptoms or kind of being like, oh, we think that, you know, something needs to happen here. I also found that those with a later diagnosis also had lower levels of emotional dysregulation, peer problems, conduct and emotional problems. And again, kind of highlights that where there are less kind of co-occurring problems alongside the ADHD, it could take longer to be noticed. But I also found that some factors had no impact on diagnosis or like no association with timing, and that those were hobby frequency, physical activity, parental depression or anxiety, and maternal higher education.
Okay, so that's interesting. So, I mean, obviously we all kind of suggest physical activity as helpful in ADHD. And I think that there's I always do it and I would stand by doing it, but I am aware that the evidence base for physical activity being actively helpful is not great. So the fact that, because that goes against one of the narratives of ADHD is that the reason why we've got ADHD is that everyone's got these horribly sedentary lifestyles and so the children, but that doesn't really, I mean, you would expect, therefore, that the more physical activity, the less ADHD, but you're not finding that, which is interesting.
No, that was just the timings. And it is the variable that I used was quantifying it from like physical activity in like clubs and stuff like that. So it may be we did consider that, you know, maybe it's the fact that those with ADHD are less likely to go to the sports clubs.
Yes, that's probably true as well.
Whether that's because, you know, behavioural related issues or, you know, their family probably have ADHD as well and managing a calendar.
They keep forgetting to pay the direct debit.
exactly. They have to take them there, they have to pick them back up again, they have to pay them, they have to buy them, wash the uniforms, that sort of thing. There's a lot of stuff involved in that. So, more stuff in that area would be really interesting. But I think actually when I did the second aim, which was the unrecognized versus recognized, it was found that in the unrecognized ADHD group there was more physical activity. So potentially
in the unrecognized ones,
in the unrecognized, it was more,
now that's interesting,
more associated with the unrecognized group. So whether potentially, you know, it was acting in the way that you kind of would expect it to, or there were other reasons, such as, I mean, if they were unrecognized, they were just more likely to still be in sports clubs, things like that. Interesting one.
Yeah, all the ones who were unrecognized are the ones who are functioning well, and then who are able to, who may have the symptoms but are adaptive, who are, I mean, there's symptoms and then there's function. And the two are not entirely linear. They're not in a completely linear relationship, exactly. In my view.
I feel like you could do a whole thing on just physical activity alone, really. So,
people do, I'm sure.
Yeah. 100%. So, it's one of those things where, at the end of every paper, you're like, wow, future research.
Hang on a bit. That's our fifth question. So we need to. We shouldn't jump on a. We shouldn't. We should come back to that. shall we? I've got two ways I want to go. I could either want to ask you about. Actually, let's talk about what else was a factor of being recognized versus unrecognized, which obviously is a much better word than diagnosable. So let's do that.
Absolutely. In the unrecognized ADHD group, they were more likely to have higher cognition. better pro-social skills, more physical activity, as I said, and they were less likely to have a parent with depression or anxiety, lower levels of emotional dysregulation, peer problems, conduct and emotional problems, or a diagnosis of autism when compared to the recognised group. And kind of, again, we'll just highlight that potentially it may be helpful, these factors may be either helpful for masking and kind of like coping with the ADHD potentially, or things that would just make it, you know, fewer emotional and behavioural problems can protect you, as you're less likely to stick out, essentially. And being picked up, and therefore more likely to, despite having these ADHD symptoms, fall into the unrecognised group.
Yeah, because it may be that a proportion of these people are actually doing all right. So,
yes, I mean, potentially.
Or it could be that they're masking their symptoms and it's a bad... I suppose, we kind of come back to it, but there is an assumption with any sort of late diagnosis any study of late diagnosis or discussion of late diagnosis, that late diagnosis is a bad thing. Mm. And that is obviously I don't necessarily, because you're just researching it, but you may have a view yourself. I think this is quite nuanced, isn't it? This is just suggesting quite a nuanced picture.
Extremely nuanced. And I think this is where qualitative research becomes really quite significant, quite poignant. And you realize that, yes, they may not have struggled. They might have got good grades. They might have had friends, but internally they were battling with a lot of like self-doubt and kind of like self-criticism and things like that. And there are qualitative studies that I do like, you know, talk about quite often, where it is that there is a mixture of regret that people feel when they get diagnosed in adulthood, where they're like, if I'd had this earlier, yes, I got, you know, B's at school, but I could have got A's. I could have got A stars.
Yeah.
I was doing good, but I could have done even better. And it's kind of like they're kind of, you know, the grief of lost potential and the kind of combined relief of kind of finally being able to understand why they are the way they are. Because again, even if you're managing correctly, you can still get annoyed at yourself if you're always forgetting. You might be doing well at work, but I was diagnosed at 22, so I did my undergraduate before getting diagnosed, my entire degree, and I was like, wow, all those things that could have been different had I been diagnosed when I was at school. So obviously I was achieving well enough to go into university. I did pretty well at school. I was still battling with other problems and things like that, and I think that's you know why qualitative research is so essential, because you get the things you don't really pick up in kind of like longitudinal data. It's how people feel about these things.
Exactly, because this data is fascinating, and we're not sort of going to dismiss and critique your own study on a podcast. We're not going down that well with your supervisor, but it is only one bit. It doesn't tell you what's going on behind story. What's the story behind all of these people, all these individuals? Mm-hmm. It's really important.
Exactly.
So let's move on to So autism diagnosis makes it more likely that your ADHD will be recognised, which is interesting and actually reassuring for me, because I see far too many kids who've been diagnosed with autism and their ADHD has been completely mixed because it's been ascribed to their autism.
Yeah, and I mean, until 2013, one was an exclusion.
Oh, I know.
Area for the other. It was a whole thing. And actually so you mentioned how I can't remember what your point was, but it was like how you said how maybe this sample you know they don't get picked up because there's like we talked about how there wasn't as many problems and things like that. I did a further analysis, which was where they had high symptoms and a high impact score.
That's also part of the SDQ.
Yes. So we didn't do that as the whole thing, because that it's not like there wasn't quite full data for that, like full coverage, and it made the sample sizes very small. But when we did do that for the recognized versus unrecognized, it actually showed that the only difference was autism, where those with recognized ADHD were more likely to have an autism diagnosis. And that was the only difference, which is really interesting. So
that's people with ADHD symptoms and a high AMPAC score. Yeah. The thing that made a difference was if they also had an autism diagnosis.
Yes, that so meant in a they sense, were more likely to fall into the diagnosed group rather than being undiagnosed with high AMPAC.
So in a sense, it means that once they've got that one diagnosis, they're kind of in the system, and therefore they're more likely to have got the other one at some point.
that's what it's implying. Yeah, obviously, you know, no causation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What's actually going on underneath these numbers is really interesting. But that's actually quite reassuring from my perspective.
Yeah.
And so let's move on to the sex differences. That's mm-hmm. that's obviously really, really important and a kind of very hot topic.
Yes. Yeah. So no, yeah, that's kind of like, yeah, one of the core questions of my PhD, as well as like this paper and, you know, further the research that I'm doing is why are there these differences?
Yes.
And in this paper, actually, I only found one sex difference, which like I was quite surprised by. But I found that emotional dysregulation differed. That was in the second comparison. So that was the people who were diagnosed versus those who were unrecognized. So yeah, I found that males who were recognized were more likely to have more emotional dysregulation compared to their unrecognized peers. But there was no difference between females. And we had a lot of discussions about this and why it might be. We talked about, you know, gender stereotypes and how girls are seen to be emotional and have, you know, maybe more big emotions, things like that. Maybe, you know, if boys were having them, maybe it was just put down to, you know, just classic, especially when you consider that these people were born in 2000. So this was like 2005 to 2014, this data was collected. And, you know, things are improving all the time in terms of like recognizing like stereotypes and things like that. And we kind of talked about that and whether it was down to gender stereotypes, things like that. Yeah.
So would females have were they more likely to be a later diagnosis? If they did have a diagnosis?
So in this study, it was actually fairly even in the, but I think it's hard because it's not necessarily late. It's only up to age 14.
Yes, exactly. That doesn't really count in the grand scheme of things.
I call it later rather than late diagnosis.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it doesn't really qualify. But so whilst they were, I think it was 51 earlier, 55 later of the females. But in the unrecognized group, there were 440 females, which is no context yet. But if you look at the ratios for the males to females in the later versus earlier groups, the ratio of the females in the recognized and diagnosed group are so much larger, where there are so many more males than there are females. But when you look at the unrecognized group, it's a much more even number.
Yeah, so you're saying, so overall, you can just about speculate that if you're going to have ADHD symptoms and you're male, you're more likely to get that recognized and picked up.
Yes, that's what it was implying, that in the same as kind of what you see in population and clinical samples, generally there was a much more even sex split in the unrecognized group, where you were just measuring their symptoms and they didn't have a diagnosis, compared to the diagnosed group where there was way more males than there were females.
And how even were the symptom distribution? Were symptoms more likely in males than females? Were high levels of symptoms more likely in males than females, irrespective of whether they're recognized or not?
So are you asking, like, regardless of diagnosis, did the SDQ report higher or lower in male or female?
Exactly.
I don't know. I didn't actually look at that. That would be an interesting point for future research.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because we talk about the male-female ratio in terms of diagnosis, and we talk about the fact that, you know, 20 years ago it was about 8-1, let's just say.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends. Huge variation. Yeah. It was 10 sometimes. And it's gone down over time, and now we're looking at a situation where I haven't actually seen these figures, but I've been told on good authority that in adulthood it is more females being diagnosed than males.
I've also heard that.
Yeah, within the NHS. I think those are NHS England figures.
Yeah.
So one of the questions that I'm always thinking about is, well, what's the right level? What's the right ratio?
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? And people are going on about, oh, well, you know, all these people are getting diagnosed now, blah, 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 over diagnosis. And it's like, what's, we can't know what's overdiagnosis and what's catch up. What, especially if it is particularly females getting diagnosed in adulthood, a lot of that's catch up. It's, they should have been diagnosed earlier.
Must be.
And they weren't. And I think it won't be, you know, for another decade or so till we can actually work out what an accurate, like actual accurate representation of it is in society.
Yeah.
Because
let's drill down to the sex differences, because that's the subject of your overall PhD, I believe, and is probably the thing that I think is probably the listeners are going to want to know about most.
Yeah.
Stepping slightly away from this paper to your broader knowledge and research, why do you think women, again, using that term in its broad sense, are diagnosed later?
So my research group, actually, this is kind of our overarching aim. So my supervisor, Joanna Martin, has done quite a nice little summary paper on this, which is fantastic. And it's down to, a mixture of things, obviously. Everything is made up of little bits causing impact. But things like the diagnostic criteria primarily built on male experiences and how males have typically presented with the condition. You've also got things like stereotypes, that kind of plays into it. You've got things like alternative diagnoses, so mental health in particular, more commonly diagnosed in young people in like females, and how that might overshadow diagnoses and things like that of ADHD, like might overshadow ADHD symptoms.
Because there's an awful lot of people being given anxiety, depression diagnoses or personality disorder diagnoses, and then finally, I mean, not that you can't have anxiety and also ADHD, you very much can.
Yes.
But the ADHD, which may be underlying it or also in the mix, is not being picked up. So,
yeah. And I've read similar for eating disorders and things like that. And again, whilst it's you can have both, but the underlying thing might be ADHD. And once the ADHD is managed, you might find the other things like eating disorders, depression, anxiety, much easier to manage, and OCD as well, I think. But all those things that obviously completely can co-occur, it sometimes helps to diagnose the underlying ADHD and help manage that, and that in turn helps management of the other things. But yeah, in terms of depression, anxiety as well, it's much easier to get a depression or anxiety diagnosis in the UK, definitely. So I imagine that also, comes into it a little bit. I mean, yeah, you can go to the doctors and they'll quite easily, confirm or deny whether they think you have depression, but ADHD requires referrals and waiting lists.
Huge waiting lists. I mean, of course, that's one of the problems with actual function of the system.
Oh, yeah.
Which we seem to mention every single episode at the moment.
Yeah, I feel like it's not, I was about to say it's an elephant in the room. It's not even the elephant in the room. It's the party in the room that everyone's talking about, but no one really wants to be there, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It is the number one issue at the moment. Slightly beyond the scope of this particular podcast, but certainly not beyond the scope of ADHD UK's work, which we are very heavily involved with trying discussions about that. Okay, so we've got these sex differences.
Yes.
I'm not saying this is something that I believe, but it is said that there's something about being female, the sort of, the chromosomal stuff or hormonal stuff, that is somehow protective, and that the reason why girls and women are diagnosed later is that they're simply not as severely affected by ADHD. Now, I have some thoughts about that, but I wanted you to go first.
Yeah, so I think that's an interesting point that is made fairly often. And I think there's kind of two ways to look at it. So there's the way that women and girls are perceived. So that is the way that, especially with ADHD, like they're not expected to have ADHD by a lot of people. So it's not necessarily interpreted that way. And like there are studies where they write ADHD symptoms on a card. And if it's got a boy's name, they'll identify ADHD and
they
won't, and that sort of thing. So I think there's that
like
way
your Bayesian priors when you're coming into a scenario and you know whether it's a boy or a girl, your priors are different.
Exactly, like what, like it just stereotypes essentially. So there's that way of looking at it. And then there's also and again, this is probably more this is probably getting less of a thing hopefully as society kind of progresses, but the way that the girls are socialized compared to boys, and you know, they're encouraged to be more social perhaps and things like that, whereas as boys have a bit more of a leniency. And I definitely don't think this is true for everyone, and I do think this is improving, but you know, these things stick around for a long time before kind of, you know, everything can even out and people stop giving dolls to girls and boys get electric cars sort of things. So the way that the girls tend to be socialized is in a way that might encourage, you know, perhaps more or like encourage less visible symptoms. You know, they might
be visible
twiddling
symptoms
their hair rather than throwing paper aeroplanes.
Yes, that's a very good, that's an excellent, very lovely encapsulation of the difference, isn't it? But internally, it probably feels the same. I mean, I think one of the things that I always say to this kind of point that people make, which I don't think is a particularly helpful point, is that if you look at the state in which the mental health of women were at the point of diagnosis, and I don't have necessarily a huge amount of data on this, but we know that the state of that often women come to a diagnosis of ADHD already in mental health crisis, whereas men would often come through school in more of a kind of disciplinary crisis within the school system or a learning crisis, but not in that kind of mental health crisis in quite the same way, although obviously sometimes it does. So to say that it's not affecting, that suggests to me quite similar to what you're saying, in that it's affecting people, but not in a way that society, it's affecting girls, but not in a way that society actually picks up because it's not disruptive to others. So I think that's...
And the kind of key takeaway from my thing was that, like, even if people aren't having these emotional behavioral things that are kind of, disruptive and being picked up, they still have ADHD symptoms at the end of the day. And regardless of whether or not people around them are perceiving that as being a problem, why stick around and wait and find out? The sooner people can understand their own brains, put management like techniques in place, the better things are going to be for them in the long term, and that the long term, you know, outcomes of unmanaged ADHD are going to be better for them because they'll have had the best chance.
So that does bring us on to implications, which is our third question, of course. What would you say the data that you're looking at in the round, what's the implication if you're a clinician, if you're running an ADHD service, or actually perhaps if you're a health authority or a commissioner going, well, how do we make sure that ADHD gets picked up efficiently within our district, within Cardiff, for instance?
I just think that if ADHD symptoms are identified, which I think is possible with or without, you know, behavioural or emotional things and things like that, they should be taken as seriously as they would be in somebody who is perhaps being picked up in other domains, and that just the recognition that there's more going on than you might notice, like particularly in school, particularly, you know, in females, that an ADHD symptoms are ADHD symptoms.
So can you just say what you mean by that?
The symptoms are the symptoms. They have symptoms of a condition that could be managed with techniques or advice or medication or anything. And they're kind of very much linked with the behavioural, emotional and other things, but are unique in their own way. And if you have ADHD symptoms and if you have enough to meet a cutoff, you have enough to meet a cutoff. And that should kind of be, obviously you understand schools have limited resources, clinics have limited resources. They will probably want to prioritize some over the others, but you know, that shouldn't come at the expense of others.
Yeah, I think because there are some clinics who are kind of saying, well, if you're not, you know, if you're not having any, if you're not failing in school, and if you're not falling behind in school, and you haven't had any exclusions, then you don't get referred in, and that's very dangerous, I think, for exacerbating this kind of.
You're waiting for a later life crisis, you know, yeah, like
essentially
in women, it's like, you know, when they have kids and they suddenly have to look after everybody's lives and their own, or, you know, they go through menopause and have hormonal changes, when people go to university, when things kind of go up in the air, and kind of the longer you leave it, you're just kind of like waiting for things to become severe enough for it to be a crisis, when you could step in beforehand and stop people from reaching crisis points, which is possible if people are equipped with the resources as early on as possible.
And what I suppose, and I suppose that brings us on to the next question, which is, what are the implications for people with ADHD themselves, or people who have the symptoms who may not have a diagnosis yet? What are the implications of, actually, what would you say to them just generally, not necessarily just from your paper, but from your research and from your, you know, experience?
Generally, I'd say if you think you have ADHD symptoms, that is enough to implement ADHD management techniques. Even if you only have, like, you know, a few, but you think you've read this tip for an ADHD person, which is, you know, using a specific type of planner, or, you know, body doubling. If it works for you, it works for you. You don't need to kind of look into it any more than that. Have people like, oh, well, you know, maybe I have ADHD, but I probably wouldn't meet the criteria. I'm like, well, I don't care. If you find something that is meant for ADHD people that helps you, implement it, put it in place, download an app that you check things off, like make a fancy to-do list. So that's kind of what I tell people. That's what I tell my friends who come to me about this sort of thing. I found my paper quite personally validating as well, in the fact that there are other people out there who, so like I said, like, obviously, I mean, I'm doing a PhD, I achieve fairly well at school, I have like a wonderful network of friends, things like that. And obviously I've struggled with a lot of things. I mean, I have diagnosed ADHD, so I have had my difficulties. And there is kind of that almost imposter syndrome with having ADHD, but still kind of doing things that stereotypically you might not be expected to do. And
as in, you're an imposter as an ADHD person.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, maybe I don't have ADHD and it's all fake.
Yeah.
As well as obviously imposter syndrome that comes with a PhD in academia in general, because
or being a doctor.
exactly. It's imposter syndrome everywhere. And that, you know, there are loads of unrecognized people and people who are recognized earlier who are struggling, and it is just potentially those around you who just aren't recognizing your specific struggles as
So the message is, if you're struggling, even if you're not showing any of these disruptive behaviors, even if you're you know, you're getting B's or whatever at university, I know what you're saying, the person who looks back and says, I could have got A's, but actually for me it's much more important is, I could have been happier, I could have been under less stress,
myself, I could have understood why I struggled with these things. And I think if you're having these thoughts and these feelings, it's worth speaking to someone, even if, again, you're like, oh, I don't know. Speak to your GP, speak to a psychiatrist, anyone who is kind of like trained in that sort of thing, and discuss with them. And it was, we have a youth advisory group of neurodivergent young people who we work with our research, which is really great. So it's been kind of really useful working with them. We've got one coming up this week, actually. So that's also really nice, because we can say to them, like, do you think that this research is useful? And they're all like, yeah, it is. It's fantastic. It's answering questions that they might have, or things that they're like, we think this is true, but we don't have, you know, the evidence, like, you know, big evidence to support it. We just have what we've been chatting to our friends about. So I think that's also something quite nice that's come from the paper, the fact that, not only obviously my lived experience is just my lived experience, that we have these young people as well that we talk to when we're developing stuff. And
okay, fantastic. Sorry?
I'm saying you're worthy of exploring ADHD management and diagnosis if you have the symptoms. So
yes, exactly. I mean, and I think that's right. I'm not advocating necessarily that everybody can get a diagnosis on demand and that we do away with the process of assessment. But if you have the symptoms and you find some stuff that helps you from the ADHD bag of tricks, absolutely you should use them. There's no question about that whatsoever, particularly as any age, but as a child, obviously somebody would be doing it for you on your behalf most of the time. But I mean, that's always been the position and it saved me a lot of hassle. It took me for people to do that. You can start getting on with it before they get anywhere near me clinically. Okay, fantastic. So you're obviously in the middle of a PhD, so this slightly answers itself, this question, but what is the next research? What from this paper, from this data, from the millennial cohort? It's the millennium cohort, not the millennial cohort.
Born in the year 2000.
A cohort of millennials, which is a different thing.
Yeah.
I suppose when they first started it, they hadn't thought of that potential confusion 25 years down the line. No, of course not. So what would you like to do next, either with this data set or what comes from this paper that you would like to look at next?
So I've actually just started kind of on my next study, which is I'm using a different data set, which is also really cool. It's the Child and Adolescent Twin Study Sweden, which is a Swedish longitudinal study of twins. So I'm kind of building on what I did in the MCS. And in this one, they are directly connected to the health record, so I can have exact age of diagnosis. So I'm kind of going to be using that data to kind of build on what I've, particularly the autism stuff I can look at again in this data set, but with kind of more exact age of ADHD diagnosis, and also goes up a bit older as well. That's what I'm going to be looking at next. Very similar questions. Why are some people getting diagnosed and why are some people not getting diagnosed despite having ADHD symptoms? What's impacting on the age at which people are getting diagnosed? Is there anything standing out here? And then obviously, what are the sex differences?
Absolutely.
What's differing between the groups? What it, are these things potentially associated with why some females are often diagnosed much later than males? Or is it beyond the scope of the study, which happens?
Yeah, of course, absolutely. And you're using the Swedish one because they have this phenomenal national birth registry where everybody basically gets all of their data captured, and they have this amazing goldmine of information that people can mine. I suppose one thing that's been sort of nagging at the back of my mind is just to go back to your list, is what's the relationship between family income and diagnosis? Do we know that?
I think it's one of those really, so the thing with that sort of thing, it's obviously very linked to socioeconomic status, things like that. And it's just so interlinked with ADHD generally when you consider that ADHD is so heritable. People with ADHD, particularly when it's unmanaged or unmanaged at all. They're more likely to struggle and not do as well financially, work at school and things like that. And then they are likely to have offspring also with ADHD. So it's just all very interlinked. So when you're looking at people and their family income, you've then got to consider the parents, and they probably have some ADHD symptoms there.
Yeah.
And it's just all very interlinked, and I feel like the arrows would be going back and forth,
all over the place.
Exactly, and it's just something to consider when looking at all those kind of factors that parents are more likely to have ADHD than parents of offspring with no ADHD. So,
yeah, and I think that's right. I think there's a little bit of a movement, there's a bit of a tendency to make a distinction between people who have difficult upbringing and ADHD, and somehow the difficulty of the upbringing is blamed for the ADHD, and other people who've got perhaps a little bit of an easier time who have purer ADHD in some way. I've always rejected that, and I think because I think that the kids from the difficult background, they just have a worse time of it. Their function is generally worse because their environment is more adverse. But the ADHD is exactly the same. I've never seen that distinction, and I really want to reject that.
No, it's about scaffolding and what support networks you have around you. If you've got more money, you're more likely to put them into after school clubs that will be like stimulating. You're more likely to be able to afford the basic necessities. When you're more financially stable, you're less stressed. You're able
Absolutely.
Deal and manage with everything better.
You're more likely to have a job that has regular hours.
Exactly.
And you'll be there at the weekends and evenings.
Anything like that. It's about ADHD management, in my opinion, rather than, more or less ADHD. It's just, the ease. I mean, everything's worse if you have no money. So.
That is true.
Yeah. I'm a PhD student, so yeah.
Sorry? Exactly. Okay, that was all I wanted to ask you. Was there anything that you particularly wanted to bring up or one of the anything that you particularly think is a really important message from your work?
I think I've covered everything that I wanted to about the paper. And I've also, I'd like to say I'm very vocal about the fact that I have ADHD, and I just think that's so important. I think having people with lived experience researching the things that they have lived experience in is something that should be shouted from the rooftops. I think it's a really really bigging myself up. I think I bring a really valuable insight into
I think that is a really important point to end on. I haven't done a survey, but we've done 25 episodes of the show, and I think we're approaching a third of our respondents who also have ADHD. But I suspect that the people who have ADHD who are also researching ADHD are the ones who reply to my email, because they're the ones who want to talk about it.
Yes, 100%, almost, I would say 100%, I'm putting statistics into something that doesn't exist, but yes, no, I think that is definitely the people that want to speak about it, the people who want to raise awareness. It's because they're just so aware of how important it is to
exactly speak about it. Yeah, that's I think that's my feeling anyway, but we'll see. I may collect that data for a Christmas special or something. I don't know.
Oh, that'd be nice.
See how we go. All right. Well, thank you very much, Isabella, and goodbye.
Brilliant. Yeah, thank you so much.
Okay, so that was Isabella.
Yes. Thank you, Isabella.
Thank you, Isabella. And hopefully, she's embarking on some quite interesting stuff now with some other kind of data sets. So she might be someone to watch for the future.
Yes.
And the other thing that you didn't know is that she herself has ADHD. So she's a sort of passionate advocate for kind of people being picked up.
Lovely.
And getting their diagnosis. So yes, definitely someone who it was very lovely to meet, and hopefully we'll meet again. Anything else to say today, Tessie?
How are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm quite tired and I've got to go to work tomorrow. So other than that...
Well, in that case, we better wrap this up quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
We did drag on a little bit. We dragged on a little bit. Like you said, I think that's important.
Yeah. So, the only other thing to say is if you are new to the pod, you might not have heard of the Facebook group. Please, I know Facebook is evil and Mark Zuckerberg is evil.
Is eagle.
He's eagle. He told you I was tired.
He is.
He's
working
eagle.
On the inside with
He's
the Americans.
An evil eagle.
Yeah.
But that is the best platform at the moment.
Yes.
For having a group, so we have it on there. Yes, so...
we'll see you there.
See you there.
And we'll see you in our next episode.
Yes, which is going to be soon.
Follow, subscribe. Then you'll be notified when we release our next episode. Yeah.
A couple of weeks.
We'll be right there.
A couple of weeks and we'll get everyone out. All right, bye-bye.
Bye.